If you're looking for a way to help birds or take your support to the next level, this May, I would love for you to join the Birds Canada Birdathon. It's easy to participate in and helps raise thousands of dollars for bird conservation. Learn more at birdscanada.org/birdathon. Now let's get to the episode. You're listening to The Warblers, a Birds Canada podcast. I'm Andrea Gress.
And I am Andres Jimenez.
Join us as we travel on common flight paths with our guests, gaining insights and inspiration from the world of birds and bird conservation in Canada. Today we're chatting with Carrie Wilcox. She's Birds Canada's bird feeding expert. She runs Project Feeder Watch, a program that's been running for decades and has taught us so much about bird population trends in Canada. And remember how we asked you to send us your bird-related questions? We've gotten so many. Thank you for that. So after we've chatted with Carrie, we're going to dive into some of those. Really excited to hear what you've got for us. Hey, Andreas, how's it going?
It's been good. I'm enjoying the sunshine. Even though November is here, it's been very cold, but so much sunshine.
I'll take the cold with the sun literally any day over rain.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like the rain in the tropics because it's very warm rain and all the frogs and snakes come out of play.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. But like, I grew up in Canada. So when it's raining, it's often a little bit colder. And Saskatchewan was a super sunny childhood, so I miss the sunshine every single day.
Well, talking about sunshine, the person we're going to talk today is definitely pure sunshine. Carrie is gonna talk to us about Feeder Watch, and she's going to talk to us about feeders. And I have so many questions about when to feed birds, how to feed them, so people can get started.
Yeah, it's going to be a really good one.
All right, let's get into it.
Carrie, thank you so much for joining. Before we dive into the questions, could you tell folks where you are right now?
I am at Birds Canada, and I'm sitting in the library. That's in Port Rowan, Ontario, so on the north shore of Lake Erie.
And for everyone that has not been to Birds Canada, we had, like, everyone has binoculars, and they're placed all over the office.
Yeah, it's so cool. You're sitting in the office, and someone will run into the room and be like, oh, look out the window, there's, you know, XX, whatever. Everybody kind of rushes out there all together.
Yes.
Perks. Definite work perks. All right, let's dive in. How did bird feeding get started, like bird feeders in particular?
Bird feeding caught on in North America in the late 1890s. It started with people just throwing, you know, their scraps from meals out in their backyard for the birds. And then it just really caught on. And since then, it's been like a bird feeding revolution. The first commercial bird feeder in North America was a hummingbird feeder, and that was produced in 1926.
1926. Okay, so Carrie, there might be a whole lot of new people that have never seen a feeder, have never placed a feeder, and they think that bird feeder, or they might think that bird feeding is, you know, throwing food to the pigeons. Can you give us a sense of what it is, this bird feeding culture, and how big bird feeding is?
Bird feeding has just grown into this huge industry, as it's so much fun to see birds close up right outside your window. So a lot of people get enjoyment from seeing the birds, seeing their colors and their behaviors. And so now the bird feeding industry has grown to have feeders targeted to all different kinds of species and how to attract them, and different seeds to attract different species. So it's really, really become a fun hobby for a lot of people.
And it's also such a healthy bond. So since the pandemic's been happening, we now have a feeder in the backyard. My wife is super stressed at work. And last time she was sitting, just kind of loading up all the feeders, and she went, you know, this is what manages my stress every day, to wake up at 6, fill the feeders, put them out there, and see who's coming to eat.
That's awesome. I get so many emails from Feeder Watch participants saying how much joy they get out of watching the birds at their feeders, and especially during the last 2 years with the pandemic and how birds have really just been a bright spot for them, especially the ones working from home.
And why do you think people love feeding birds so much, especially at home?
It's the opportunity to see them close up from the comfort of your own kitchen, like sitting and having a coffee in the morning and watching all the birds come to your feeder. It's just a lot of fun. And for me, it's also turned into a photography hobby as well. So people with an interest in photography get these amazing views of birds right out their window. Bird feeding is also really educational. Just observing the birds out your window will help you learn their behaviors, how to identify different species. You see their different personalities, and the birds outside your window are constantly changing.
I like that. And often when I'm visiting people who have feeders set up, they'll pause in the conversation and be like, oh, hold on, my Oriole just came back. And they'll pause to have a look at that. You know, my bird has come back, and they kind of form a bond with the birds that are repeat visitors, and then equally will stop a conversation and be like, hold on, what is that? This is a brand new bird at my feeder. So it's pretty cool. So Carrie, is feeding wild birds a good thing?
Well, this is a tricky question. It's really difficult to assess like the costs and benefits of bird feeding for birds, because it's hard to compare their health and reproductive success with birds that don't have access to feeders. So a lot of the studies have focused on the nesting season, and birds that have access to supplemental food have more young and healthier young. So it means that they're doing well, but we don't have a lot of information about winter fed birds. So this year, for the first time for Feeder Watch, we're collecting data from participants that don't have feeders. This will give us some comparison data to understand the impact of bird feeding on birds.
That's really cool. So, like, if you're someone renting a basement suite and you don't actually have, like, ownership over the front yard, you can still participate without a feeder.
And that's right. And if you live in an apartment, you could, you know, come downstairs and spend, you know, once a week and have a look, and you can still participate even though you don't have your own feeders.
And what is the biggest gain or opportunity that we get from feeding birds?
I think that the biggest benefit of bird feeding is the connection it builds with nature. So without that connection, people just aren't going to be interested in nature and conservation. So a connection with birds makes people want to protect their habitat and to do things that will benefit them, like garden for birds and plant native species and provide lots of habitat for birds.
Heck yeah. Shout out to our Gardening for Birds episode right there.
And I realized that one of the connections the feeder generates with the world is that we get to see who interacts with who, who's friends with who, because blue jays also give the alarm warning every time a cat is close by. And so it's been awesome because we have neighbor cats that keep on coming to our feeders, and the blue jays call the alarm and everyone's gone.
So how do you effectively, safely, and responsibly feed birds?
Well, we have lots of tips on both the Birds Canada site and the Project Feeder Watch site about how to safely feed birds. And first of all, my biggest tip is keep your cats indoors. Outdoor cats are the leading cause of human-related bird mortality. They kill between 100 and 350 million birds every year in Canada. So the feeders make birds really easy targets for birds. Clean your feeders. We recommend cleaning them every 2 weeks, and this is to stop the spread of disease. So scrub and soak them with mild bleach if you see any sign of disease, and regularly rake underneath your feeders so that there's no debris underneath that'll go mildewy or accumulate droppings where birds could be eating, and remove any seeds that are wet because they can go mildewy. So just responsible bird feeding will prevent disease at your feeders. Make sure you have feeders that are filled with no-mess feeds so that there's no seeds falling down on the ground. And you can also have something to catch the seeds so that you're not getting any seeds on the ground, because yes, they will attract rats in some areas. I have a big table underneath my feeders, which catches everything. And I provide a lot of peanuts and other types of food that are no mess. So there is nothing accumulating underneath the feeders. We also recommend preventing window strikes. And there's lots of things you can do to prevent birds from being killed by your windows. You can break up the reflections with streamers or use bird-safe window films. Or you can just put the screens for your windows on the outside of the windows.
And of course, if it's further from the window, people can get decals like what Feather Friendly offers.
Yes.
Okay, so I think there's a lot of questions that every new feeder watcher has on their mind. So let's go through a few of those with you. So should I feed birds year-round?
I personally think you can feed birds year-round as long as you're feeding them responsibly. I didn't used to feed birds in the summer, and the last 2 years I have. And I've discovered it is so much fun to feed birds in the summer because I had a family of downy woodpeckers. I had a family of red bellies. And I had both Baltimore and orchard orioles the entire summer and all these juveniles. It was just awesome to feed in the summer.
You must have quite an impressive feeder setup at home. Like, how many feeders do you have?
I do have a very impressive setup. My husband built me a whole like feeder deck and a table that has the post that goes straight up through the middle so that to hold them all up straight. And then we made like a raised garden with cedar trees to provide cover for the birds to land in that come to my feeders. And yes, I have a very elaborate setup.
That sounds pretty awesome.
Kerry, before Andrea continues talking about these initial questions a new feeder watcher will have, I have one question that seasoned feeder watchers usually have, and I have one theory as well. I remember that I've been asked so many times, how do I keep the hawks that eat other birds away from my feeder? First thing I would say is don't keep them out. It's amazing to see them hunt. But if you're very close to your birds and you don't want them to eat your birds, I installed a J feeder because I was like, okay, so if I don't want this sharpshin hawk that is around my feeder, what do I do? So you bring on the gang. You bring on the mobbers. And so I started trying to use ecological thinking and I put up a peanut feeder. And since the blue jays have been here, which are usually the ones mobbing out the hawks, I haven't had any hawks again. Do you think that's a good theory?
I love that idea. I'm going to pass that one along to feeder watchers. What a great idea. And you suggested that it has been working. For hawks, we've also suggested taking your feeders down for a couple of weeks so that they will learn to hunt in a different location. But I also tell people that like a Cooper's hawk is going to eat the equivalent of a mourning dove every day. So even if it's not eating it at your feeder, it's still going to be eating it somewhere else. So
so if I were just starting out, where should I put a feeder?
You should put it where there is some shrubs or some escape cover because they'll feel more comfortable about coming to your feeder if they've got a little bit of protection around them from hawks or from the wind. So it would be great to have just a little close to shrubs, that type of thing. Also, I would recommend putting them as close as you can to your window, like within three feet. If a bird is frightened by a hawk, they flush from their feeders by having it super close. It prevents any serious injuries.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that makes it a bit safer for them if they did bump into the window. It's not a hard crash.
It's really critical to that your birds are safe that are visiting your feeders. Also, you know, it's great to have more than one feeder because that way you can, they're not clustered. So they're spread out between feeders and there's less risk of disease if they're spread out too.
Mm-hmm, that makes sense. Do you find, so you could spread it out and have one type of feeder in one area and a different feeder in a different spot, and maybe that limits some of that competition between different species?
Yes, yes. It's fun to attract different species. Try putting out a suet feeder to attract woodpeckers. Niger seed is awesome for attracting finches, so American goldfinches or house finches. And peanut feeders are fantastic for blue jays and woodpeckers. And I have a tufted titmouse at my feeder, which seems to love the peanut feeder.
So back to some of those beginner questions. When's the best time to put out feeders?
Often, it takes birds a little while to find your feeders. So I say usually to give birds like 2 weeks. So if you're just putting up your feeders for feeder watch, at least get them up a couple weeks ahead of time, because birds find feeders by sight and it might take them a little while to search out your new feeders. And they're also kind of weary of new feeders too if you switch some of your feeders. Sometimes it takes them a couple weeks before they start using the new one.
Learned from direct experience, I take it.
Yes, yes. I got a new hummingbird in the feeder in the summertime, and it took at least 2 weeks before the hummingbird started using it. They boycotted it and used all my other feeders instead.
That's hilarious that they're like still in the yard, but not touching that new thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got the exact same food in it.
Should we feed them during the spring and fall migration?
Migration is triggered by day length. So no amount of food in your feeders is going to stop birds from migrating. So your feeders might actually be that extra little boost of energy that they need on their migration. So I think feeding birds during migration is great. And it's a lot of fun. That first rose-breasted grosbeak of the spring is like, is so much fun. And when the orioles return.
Mm-hmm. Kind of helps you feel that, you know, either spring is coming or like, oh, winter's coming, you know, being able to see these birds passing through.
Yes, I do get that question a lot.
So, Carrie, are there any human foods that are unsafe for birds?
Bread is not a good idea. It has no nutritional value for them, and it fills them up so they aren't eating healthy foods. There's also foods in the summertime that can go rancid, like lard and some kinds of suet. So if you're feeding birds in the summertime, you can buy special summer suet, but don't put out your own suet or suet that you buy from a butcher's.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. It kind of feeds into the whole idea of keeping the area clean.
Yes. Yeah. Don't put out anything that's going to rot.
Yeah. And I think we all understand the concept of like too much junk food means we're not eating nutritional salads and all the, you know, all the good stuff, right? So it's the same for birds. And so if I were to plunk my first feeder in the backyard today, what's a good one to start with?
My number one choice would be a tube feeder with black oil sunflower seed. Black oil sunflower seed is the most preferred seed. It's the one that most species will eat. It's high in fat and it's small enough that the little birds can crack it open like with small beaks. So if I were just starting and had one feeder, it would be a tube feeder and black oil sunflower seed.
And I love that you kind of dispel this myth that many people say, well, you know, if you have your feeders out in the fall, then the birds are going to stay here. And thank you for that, Carrie. I bet many people might have that question.
Awesome. So to summarize for the newbies, we can start feeding, expect them to take a couple of weeks to find our feeders. We can feed them during migration, no problem. Kind of figure out the right habitat in the backyard, consider the windows and cats and predator birds and things like that. Put some healthy food in there and away we go. Now, are there any situations that I should avoid feeding the birds?
I would suggest if you have a lot of cats roaming in your backyard that I would not put up a feeder. They're just targets for cats. So that's one case where I would not put up feeders. If there's a known outbreak in your area of salmonella or another disease or trichomoniasis, I would not put out feeders until the outbreak is gone. And bears, if you are up north, if you live in cottage country, do not put up feeders when bears aren't in hibernation.
Andreas, have you had a chance to see a bear yet?
I saw one in Bruce Peninsula, and I had to do a dump tour, literally going to dumps to find it. And when I found it, my girl was like, "Dad, now can we stop looking for bears?" I was like, "You ungrateful child."
Oh, dear.
Gary, you've been mentioning Feeder Watch many times, and I think it's time that we go deep into Feeder Watch. But I have one question before that. Who's your best garden friend? Who's your best, like, the ally in your garden? The bird that is always there and that you love to see and that is, like, your best friend, that you know everything about it?
My favorite bird is my tufted titmouse. I'm assuming it's the same bird. It has been coming to my feeder for 3 years, so it is my favorite.
And you see, this is why I asked Carrie about her best friend, because she knows this bird for 3 years. How many people do we know for 3 years? There isn't that many. And Carrie knows her titmouse for the past 3 years. And I bet you know when he comes, what he likes to do, what feeder does he like to go to, and who is friends with that bird.
Oh, yes. And I have probably 100 pictures of it on my camera, too.
All right. Let's go deep into Project Feeder Watch. Carrie, can you tell us what is Project Feeder Watch?
Project Feeder Watch is a winter survey of birds that visit backyards. So Feeder Watch, people simply count the birds, the numbers and the kinds of birds that visiting their feeder, and then they send that data to us online. So we ask everybody to count in the same way, but there is no minimum requirement for participating. So people decide how much time they want to spend. So even if they only count once in the season, that is really valuable information. It's like a little snapshot of the birds in their location. So that's really cool that you don't have to have a huge amount of time to participate in Feeder Watch. Feeder Watch is in its 35th year, so it's an amazing data set. So we can use this fantastic trend data to look at which species are doing well and which ones need our conservation attention. Feeder Watch data alerted us that evening grosbeaks were in trouble. Feeder Watch data shows that they've experienced a range retraction and a population decrease over the 35 years. And loss of nesting habitat and loss of food resources may be affecting them, but we can't be sure because they nest in the remote boreal forest. And we really don't know a lot about breeding conditions there because it is such a huge area. This is an example of how Feeder Watch data showed us which species were in trouble. And we now know that we need more information to understand why.
Wow, Carrie, you just brought this home for so many people. So what you're saying is that this bird that nests in the boreal forest that we struggle to go and sample and study because it's just too far and too expensive, we found out that its range was decreasing and that there were less birds and the population was decreasing due to them visiting feeders and people counting them at their feeders.
What are the key things that we've learned from Project Feeder Watch?
Really, really shows you that scientists, you know, just can't be everywhere. So we rely on data collected by, well, thousands of citizen scientists that are participating in Feeder Watch. So we have around 25,000 feeder watchers across North America, which is just this amazing set of eyes checking on birds in their own location.
Yeah, so Feeder Watch helps us learn a lot about how bird populations are doing, both the ones that are common in our backyards and the ones that maybe nest further afield. And of course, it's really helped people value and appreciate the birds in their life and appreciate nature and you know, can result in backyard birding and stuff like that to just create more habitat. So overall, it sounds like a really excellent program. How would you suggest people start on their journey with Project Feeder Watch and bird feeding in general?
if people visit our website, which is birdscanada.org/feederwatch, just make a donation of whatever amount you choose, and then you could get started right away. We'll send you all of the materials that you would need. So we send you an instruction booklet and a poster of the top 25 birds that come to feeders. This is a really great poster to help you narrow down what you're actually seeing at your feeders. It also shows them a size comparison. They're true to life in the poster. So it's a really great ID resource for people new to birding. And we also send you a calendar and a tally sheet. You can also join our Facebook community, which is the Feeder Watch Canada Facebook group. And you can share photos there, share bird feeding tips and ID questions. It's another really great spot to join the Feeder Watch community.
I love that. Sign up. You'll get lots of great resources and you can join the community and kind of learn from other bird feeding folk. And who can do this and where in Canada can you do this?
We need participants from everywhere. Data from urban areas, and we need more people in rural areas up north. We need data from across the country.
Doesn't matter where you are.
It doesn't matter where you are.
And it doesn't matter your skill level. You learn as you go.
That's right. We have lots of resources on the website to help identify birds. If you can snap a photo, even a terrible photo that shows a silhouette of the bird, we have lots of bird experts at Birds Canada that can help identify it.
This is fantastic.
Has Project Feeder Watch taught us something about climate change or about birds changing due to climate change?
Well, Cooper's hawks are a species that we've shown on Feeder Watch is doing really well. Feeder Watch data shows a consistent increase in their numbers of them visiting backyards in winter. And the increase is probably related to a number of different reasons, including warmer winters. So maybe more of them are staying north. They may have learned that feeders are a new source of food for them. And also, hawks as a whole have steadily increased their populations since DDT was banned in the 70s. So hawks as a group have increased 110%, which is amazing. And it's very cool to see the results of conservation efforts. So that is one of the really good news stories. And Feeder Watch shows their response to conservation really well.
Thank you, Carrie. We started with this question, is it a good thing to feed birds? And even though that's a hard question to answer, creating new connections and understanding our feather neighbors and also learning about these patterns and how they change, I think it's easy to answer that it's been a very good thing if we do it responsibly.
We'll have all those links in the podcast description for people as well. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about Project Feeder Watch.
Thank you, Carrie.
Well, thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
The Warblers is supported by Feather Friendly. Birds can't see glass and millions die each year because of window collisions. You can save dozens of birds by treating your windows with Feather Friendly's do-it-yourself kit or their commercial solution for large projects. The markers are easy to apply and they work. You can also double your impact by using the code BIRDSCANADA and Feather Friendly will make a donation to support bird conservation. Keep birds singing, treat your windows with Feather Friendly. Visit featherfriendly.com.
Welcome back, everyone. So we're going to try something a little bit new. We asked you guys for questions, any bird-related question over the last month or two. You guys have sent us a whole bunch, so I think it's time that we dive into those with some of our experts that work at Birds Canada and that we just know as good friends and colleagues.
The magnificent thing about this is that we get to hear your voices, but we also get to hear the voices of the amazing team at Birds Canada all across the country, and we guarantee that we will get the right expert to answer your question. So keep them coming.
Hi, my name is Nolan, and I am a 13-year-old birder from Cambridge. I have a question. Why do some birds change color in the fall and winter and not others? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. To answer it, we bring Stu McKenzie, who has been birding since he was 2 years old, and he's Birds Canada's Director of Migration Ecology. He's responsible for the MOTUS Wildlife Tracking System, the Long Point Bird Observatory, and the Thunder Cape Bird Observatory, and he's part of many aspects of the Canadian Migration Monitoring Network. Stu joins us from the field as he is, or as he prepares for a field visit to the tip of Long Point. Welcome to the podcast, Stu. It's great to have you.
Thank you very much, Andres. Well, Nolan, thank you very much for your wonderful question. And that question touches on a lot of aspects of avian ecology. So all birds molt. Just some may molt just once a year. Some may molt twice a year. Some birds molt continuously throughout their life. And some birds may molt even more times throughout the year. And the timing and the reasons for their molt varies, and it depends on whether or not they're migratory. It's quite often the timing of their molt they need to molt before they can migrate, or they may want to molt so they have fresh feathers before breeding, or there may be different seasonal reasons why they want to molt at a different time.
Why would they require to molt before migration?
Before migration, birds have just usually completed a lengthy and very hard breeding season. So by that point, their feathers are usually very tattered and worn. So before embarking on large migrations, you want fresh, oily, clean feathers that are going to be the most efficient for flying.
What about molting before breeding?
When a bird arrives on the breeding grounds, they're usually wearing feathers that they molted before migration. And there's something else that's also influencing how when birds will molt and what their plumage looks like, and that's sexual selection. So how appealing their plumage may be to members of the other sex. And usually that has an influence on males where they'll be really bright and colorful. And the other reason that might influence when birds molt or what plumage they adapt is camouflage or protection. So depending on the environments that the birds are in, they may want to molt so that they're matching the environment in which they arrive. And snow buntings is an excellent example. They're actually brown. And then when they arrive in the breeding grounds, they wear off all the brown plumage and they turn bright white to match the snow that they arrived in. And that's another reason why females tend to be more drab. They're usually camouflaged sitting on nests. And then males, for the sexual selection reason, usually be quite bright. And sexual selection just takes off crazy in some ecosystems and with some species. And that's where you get these really elaborate displays like peacock feathers or bowerbirds in the Pacific.
So that was Stu. And now let's go to our next question.
Why do some birds burrow and some birds nest?
I am so excited about this question. We've got Dr. Catherine Dale joining us. She has a PhD in biology from Queen's University, where she studied bird migration and animal personality. In 2019, she moved to St. John's, Newfoundland to coordinate the Newfoundland Breeding Bird Atlas for Birds Canada. She absolutely loves atlasing, and she's got a lot of cool stuff to share. So take it away.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. This was an interesting question. It actually really caught me off guard because in some ways, it's so basic that it's not something that I've really thought about. So I had to actually sit down and put together a little page of notes on why birds nest in different places and in different ways. So the answer is that birds actually exhibit pretty huge variation in terms of nest designs, particularly the passerines, which are the small perching birds that many of us are familiar with. And in fact, it's actually been suggested that this wide variation in nest building behavior is one of the reasons that birds as a group have been so successful in infiltrating a wide variety of niches. So when it comes to building a nest, you're essentially, or a bird is balancing protection provided by the nest, the energy expenditure required to build the nest, and basically what's possible in terms of their own morphology, their claws, their bill, what they can do, and also what's available in the habitat. So many birds, particularly here in Newfoundland, where we have all kinds of seabirds, do excavate burrows or in other cases, cavities in trees. And these are great nests because they can provide young with quite a bit more protection than other nests. So you're protected from predators, you're protected from the elements. But lots of species aren't morphologically capable of excavating a burrow or excavating a cavity in a tree. So for example, you know, woodpeckers can quite easily excavate themselves a cavity in a tree, but think about the small, thin bill of a warbler or a tree swallow, which are made for catching insects. Those aren't going to work for excavating cavities. That doesn't mean that none of those birds live in cavities. Some of those birds are what we call secondary cavity nesters, and so they actually make use of cavities that have been excavated by other species. So tree swallows, for example, will find a cavity that's been excavated by a woodpecker or even a chickadee, and they'll use that cavity for their own nest. Here, though, you have a problem in terms of what's available. So once you're not capable of excavating your own cavity, you need to be able to find another one, and cavities become a limiting resource. So lots of species, actually probably the most common type of nest that we talk about is just one of these simple open cup nests. And you might think that this is a worse option than a cavity because the young are exposed to the elements and they're exposed to predators. But actually open cup nests can be a huge advantage as well because the adults are less likely to be trapped by a predator. So if you're a tree swallow and you're in a nest cavity and a squirrel comes in or a snake comes in, you're really kind of stuck there. Whereas if you have an open cup nest, the adults can leave and attempt to breed again. And one of the things that I think is coolest about this is we also see a lot of variation in nest structure, even within the same species. So take yellow warblers, for example, they build an open cup nest. But if you look at yellow warblers breeding pretty far north, so in Churchill, Manitoba, they build much larger, less porous nests that retain heat better than the same species nesting in, say, Ontario. So essentially what it comes down to is we've got tons and tons of variation, and it's the result of this balance between protection and energy expenditure, the bird's morphology, the habitat that it breeds in, and also evolutionary history of the species.
We'll be right back.
The Warblers is a podcast of Birds Canada. Our goal is to bring you the information you need to discover, enjoy, and protect birds. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, leave a review, and share this podcast with everyone you know. Birds Canada relies on the support of donors like you. To learn more or to make a donation, visit birdscanada.org. And if you give, please note the podcast in the comment box.
Ooh, I am loving these answers. Let's move on to the third one.
Can you tell me what species of bird has the most variation? So what I mean by that is there can be one species of bird, like an eagle, but then a bunch of different types of eagles, like a bald eagle, a golden eagle, etc. So I just wondered which bird has the most variations.
For our next question, we connect with the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto with Dr. Santiago Claremont. He is an associate curator of birds at the ROM. He is also a cross-appointed assistant professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Toronto. Hola, Santiago. Bienvenido al podcast. We want to know which is the most diverse group of birds in the world.
Hola, Andres and Andrea and everyone. This is actually a simple question, but it's really fascinating. The most diverse group of birds in terms of orders is the Passeriformes, or the passerine birds, also known as perching birds. There are about 6,500 species of passerines around the globe. So more than 60% of all bird diversity is composed of passerine birds.
So for people who don't know, the passerines are perching birds, things like chickadees?
Exactly. Chickadees, cardinals, house sparrows, crows.
So, Santiago, this is the biggest group, but which one is the family with the most amount of species?
At the family level, the family with most species is the Tyrannidae, with 425 species. The Tyrannidae is the tyrant flycatchers, which is a family of insectivorous passerines that are found only in the Americas. So lots of diversity in North America, a lot of diversity also in South America.
And how many of those would you say are in Canada?
In Canada, we have about 30 species. And 10 of those will be breeding in Ontario. The runner-up is the Chaupidae, the tanagers and allies. It's actually another family that is restricted to the Americas. But in this case, we don't have species in Canada or the US. All the species are distributed in the tropical regions of the Central and South America, and including even in dry and cold regions of South America, like the high Andes or the Patagonian steppes. There are about 400 tanager species, and there are many of those are the typical small colored food birds that you can see in the tropical forest.
That's pretty incredible. So you're saying that the two families with the most species are, you know, one of them is in North and South America, and the runner-up is just South America. Why would that be?
We still don't know, but the fact is that South America or the neotropical region, which includes also tropical North America, so south of Mexico, the Caribbean, is a region with the highest number of species of birds in the world. So there's something during the evolution of birds that created a favorable environment for species production in this continent.
You heard it from Santiago, amigos. South America for the win is the place to go birding. Yeah, Santiago, thanks so much for being with us and for providing so much insight about the diversity of birds and families.
I can hear people already planning their next holiday.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that was it. Thank you so much for your questions. I was so excited to hear the voices of the people that listen to us, like Nolan. I learned so many new things from today's questions. That's it for today. Bye-bye. The Warblers is produced by Andres Jimenez, Jody Allaire, Andrea Gress, Ruth Friendship Keller, and Kate Dolish. This episode was edited by Greg McLaughlin and engineered by Katie Jean, with the music by Jose Mora and art by Alex Nico. Until next time, keep birding.